Hello, everybody. My name's Barry, and this is your Worcester magazine for May. And with me tonight, I have Alan.
Yes, all present in the correct.
Mike.
Here.
Kate.
Hello there.
And Alex, down from the Star Trek Enterprise at the engineering. Yeah. Okay, we'd like to start off tonight with Alan giving us a story from the old Worcester Postman, which is quite an old paper, and it's a story about the city with more history than any other in England. Alan.
Well, it's quite a bold statement to make, isn't it? But from simple beginnings, 5,000 years ago, Worcester has become the thriving community we know today. It can lay claim to having longer, continuous history as an inhabited settlement in any other city in Britain. At least, that's the firm view of archaeologists who have carried out exhaustive studies of its distant past. This makes it much older than, for example, those other famous cathedral cities, York, Canterbury and Lincoln, and even London. Much of the fascinating research work was carried out by eminent English archaeologist Philip Barker, who actually lives in Worcester. Evidence of the earliest habitation of the area around 5,000 years ago was revealed in astonishing detail by aerial photography in the late 1960s. Bird's eye views picked out the outline of ditches and enclosures of Bronze Age settlements from about 3000 BC in fields along the Severn from Holt and Grimley to the outskirts of Worcester. Excuse me. Mr. Barker says that archaeological excavation in the gravel terraces each side of the river also yielded scatters of flints, burial urns, and other prehistoric implements. The discoveries of even greater significance were made by digs on the Lich Street site opposite the cathedral in the mid-1960s. These unearthed evidence of a strongly fortified settlement of late Bronze or Iron Age date. That's between 800 and 100 BC. Surveys show that this settlement had originally extended southwards to extensive matches at Diglis and overlooked a long stretch of shallow river. It's capable of being forded at all times except during floods. Sometime in the 1st century AD, the Romans invaded and replaced the Iron Age settlement at Worcester with a Roman town which had greatly strengthened defences and also a large suburb to the north. At first this was residential, but in the 3rd and 4th centuries it became an important iron smelting and industrial area. There are indications too of a Roman harbour in the Diglis area. When the Roman legions eventually left, Worcester became the hometown from around the 4th century to what Mr. Barker describes as a sub-Roman Christian community. They occupy the riverside area now occupied by the cathedral and surrounding buildings. Next inhabitants of the area were a pagan tribe, the Wicci, a mix of Anglians and Saxons, who ruled a sub-kingdom from Worcester covering most of Worcestershire and some of Gloucestershire. They had their own royalty, but were only part of the huge kingdom of Mercia, embracing much of the Midlands and the borderlands between England and Wales. Worcester was the exclusive province of the Wiccis from sometime in the 600 to the 1800s, sorry, 6 to the 800s, a period during which the bishops of Worcester were also described in monastic records as the bishop of the Wiccas. The tribe, however, eventually became absorbed into the general populace of Mercia and was not heard of again after the 800s. Some Worcestershire place names incorporating Wick are believed to be derived in part from the Wicci era. Just after the Norman conquest of 1066, a castle was built in the city and lasted for nearly 500 years, a symbol of the warlike nature of the times when pitched battles on British soil were frequent. It was erected on top of an 80-foot-high man-made hill beside the Severn and near the cathedral on the orders of the King's Sheriff in Worcester, Urso Dabito. Originally, it was unlikely to be made of stone, but more resembled a Wild West stockade. However, by 1140 it was much sturdier and had at least a stone keep. Later records show King John ordered the castle gate, then of wood, to be rebuilt and constructed good and fair of stone. Over the following centuries, the importance of the castle declined. The fabric decayed. By 1613, what remained was in use as a jail. It was finally pulled down in 1813 with the building of a big new prison in Salt Lane, later to become Castle Street. Perhaps this explains why the new jail was built so much to resemble a castle. For at least four centuries during the era of the castle, Worcester was a remarkably well-fortified city, surrounded by sturdy stone walls similar to those still seen today at Chester and York. At various strategic points around the city, walls were very substantial stone with gateways. Only one survives, the Edgar Tower. Walls were built 700 years ago in the 13th century and were still fully in place in the 17th century. Sir Hubert Leicester, who was five times mayor of Worcester, tells us in his 1930 book, Forgotten Worcester, that the wall of the city was of a substantial thickness and not less than 50 feet high at any part, and in some places higher, and was bordered by a deep ditch. Now, the only places where sections of the old Worcester fortifications can be seen today are on the west side of the City Walls Road to the carriageway and alongside the south side of the Butts. Well, there you go. Didn't know a bit about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I hope it didn't bore you too much at home for those that are not interested in history. Mike, I think you've got...
I've got more history.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
But slightly different in that this is an account by Daniel Defoe on his visit to Worcester in 1724. And I think we can file it under Nothing Really Changes, because you'll see what I mean.
Yeah.
Okay, this is Daniel Defoe, who we all know from Robinson Crusoe Mole Flanders.
When did he get... I was going to look this up because I used to know this and I've forgotten.
Yeah.
Robinson Crusoe, where did he... There was a person actually did get...
There was a real-life Robinson Crusoe. I can't remember his name. That's a good challenge.
I know it was CC, something like that.
Yeah.
It was Scott's name, I'm sure.
I can't remember.
Yeah, it's pretty much a true story, I think.
The whole thing... Just it rolls on and rolls on, because the guy that was picked up from the island after being there for about 12 years or something went on to do lots of other things.
He did have an exciting life,
which perhaps we can put in the next magazine.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, this is Mr. Defoe back in 1724, and he visited our town. Not sure he was that impressed. Worcester is a large, populous, old, though not very well built city. I say not very well built because the town is close and old and the houses stand too thick. The north part of the town is more extended and also better built. There's a good old stone bridge over the Severn, which stands exceedingly high from the surface of the water. But as the stream of the Severn is contracted here by the buildings on either side, there's evident occasion sometimes for the height of the bridge, with the river's waters rising to incredible height in the wintertime. And that... We know, because I think we had about 13 floods of the century just this past winter. So, that doesn't change. He goes on, it narrowly escaped burning, but did not escape plundering at the time when the Scots army, commanded by King Charles II, was attacked here by Cromwell's forces. 'Twas said some of the royalist officers themselves proposed setting the city on fire when they saw it was impossible to avoid a defeat. and we'd better make a retreat, which they proposed to do over the Severn, and march on into Wales. But the king, a prince from his youth, of a generous and merciful dispositions, would by no means consent to it. I went to see the townhouse, which I think is the Guild Hall, which afforded nothing worth taking notice of, unless it be now mended with a new one. I don't think it has. The city, they say, is not much inclined, as they are able and rich to perform. I saw nothing of public notice there, but the three figures, for they can hardly be called statues, of King Charles I, King Charles II, and Queen Anne, and they're there to this day, by the door, yeah. Overly painted and looking quite garish and scaring off whatever tourists come round.
Yeah.
The cathedral, always comes back to the cathedral, is an ancient and indeed decayed building. The body of the church, very mean in its aspect. Nor did I see the least ornament about it. I mean on the outside. The tower is low, without any spire, with only four very small pinnacles on the corner. And yet the tower has some little beauty in it, more than the church itself. And the upper part has some images on it, but decayed by time. I actually think in our time they've actually done quite a good job.
I think they have.
Sort of repairing it using old tools and old materials. And I think we've probably seen it at its best for quite some time.
Yeah, yeah,
so that has changed. Carrying on about the cathedral, the inside has several very ancient monuments in it, particularly some royal ones, as of that of King John, who lies interned between two sainted bishops, namely St. Oswald and St. Wolston. Whether he orders his internment in that matter, believing that they should help him up at the last call and be serviceable to him for his salvation, I know not. 'Tis true they say so, but I can hardly think the king himself so ignorant, whatever the people in those superstitious times said, nor do I say it's probable. They may all go together at last, and without being assistant or acquainted with one another at all. So he's hoping to sneak in between two saints. And yes, that's our royal representative. Probably the worst king, monarch ever.
Just about, I think.
Sold his brother to the other side and lost the crown jewels in mud.
Yeah. The King John, I mean, when he got the money from all the barons around England.
Yes, to pay the ransom.
To pay the ransom to get Richard back.
Yeah.
Then he didn't send it.
No. He was bad. But he's one of our own now, so there we go.
Oh, yeah.
There's also a monument for the famous Countess of Salisbury.
Oh, yes.
Who, dancing before with King Edward III in his great hall at Windsor, dropped her garter, which the king, taking up with much honour, and instituted the new order of knighthood. And, of course, now we still have Knights of the Garter.
Yeah.
That comes from that time. Let's have a look. Let's see. Oh, yes, Prince Arthur. He's forgotten. He was the eldest son to King Henry VII, who was married but died soon after. And his wife, Catherine, the Infanta of Spain, was afterwards married to, and after 20 years wedlock, divorced from King Henry VIII. And so that's, that's a direct connection to some very turbulent times in our history. But, yes, if he lived on, things would be actually very, very different in England. I'm not going to say Brexit or anything like that. No, that's a whole other. We'll save that for Christmas. Upon the prince's tombstone is this inscription: "Here lies the body of Prince Arthur, the eldest son of King Henry VII, who died at Ludlow in the year 1502, and in the 17th year of his reign." Defoe goes on: "There are several other ancient monuments in this church, too many to set down here. They reckon up to 99 bishops of this diocese, beginning in the year 980, of which they catalogue one pope, So we've got, there's been a Worcester Pope, 4 saints, 7 High Chancellors of England, 11 Archbishops, 2 Lord Treasurers of England, 1 Chancellor to the Queen, 1 Lord President of Wales, 1 Vice President. So
that's it.
That's it.
And that was Daniel Defoe's idea of Worcester in 1724.
Yes, and that was his equivalent of TripAdvisor there. I think he must have had a bad meal or something and went off in a huff, because that's a pretty bad review of our town.
He went around England, I believe. There's a book looking around. I saw it in the library of his... views on certain places. And yes, we didn't come off too well, I must admit.
Yeah. Robinson Crusoe update.
Oh, yeah.
The story is thought to be based on the life of Alexander Selkirk.
That's right.
Yes.
A Scottish castaway who lived for 4 years on a Pacific island called Maeterra, now part of Chile.
Yeah.
Which was renamed Robinson Crusoe Island in 1966, and possibly Pedro Serrano is another real-life castaway whose story may have inspired the novel.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right the way down from Starship. Starship Alex. Okay, now we come to Kate, who's got a letter sent to the Worcester Talking News in 2016. It's an interesting little letter.
Yes, this is from someone called Anna Workman, who I don't know, and but it's not that long ago, 2016, but it's got some interesting details about a resident of Worcester. Right, as she says, I wonder whether you would be interested to hear about a 14-year-old servant girl who lived at 11 Wilds Lane, which is obviously our premises, in 1871, and what became of her. She was the servant of a Mr. M. McIntyre, a brewer's clerk, who resided there. Her name was Hannah Sophia Wood. She was my great-grandmother and the daughter of a journeyman cordwainer, that's a shoemaker. She was born in 1857 in a poor district of Oxford, and after having travelled around the country, for most of her childhood, her family arrived and settled in Worcester in 1870. She went into service and remained in service until at the age of 19, when she married Samuel Wilding, who was a glover, and the son of the local tailor, who had a shop in Sidbury and lived nearby in Prospect Place, Greenhill, off London Road. I like to think of their romance blossoming when she was sent on errands to the shop by her employer. They lived in a little terrace in Park Place. Sadly, in 1885, her fifth child died in infancy, but by 1889 she had 6 healthy children, and husband Samuel had progressed to becoming a skilled and somewhat renowned glove cutter at Found's Glove Factory. Aged 33 in 1890, his employer offered him the chance to emigrate to America to help in setting up a new factory in Glovesville, New York. Bravely, they decided to accept the offer, and the whole family sailed from Liverpool in 1890. Another daughter, my grandmother, was born in Glovesville in 1891, but Hannah was unwell and found she could not cope with the climate and the mosquitoes, which were many, as Glovesville was surrounded by swampland and hemlock forests, which supplied the bark for tanning the leather. So in December 1891, she returned, her 6 children and tiny infant daughter in tow. Her husband Samuel followed 6 months later, having completed his task for Founds. And back home, they both continued to work in the gloving industry. Hannah was a home worker, hand sewing and finishing gloves. In all, they had 10 children, 6 girls and 4 boys. At the age of 62, after 43 years of marriage, she was widowed. And then in 1929, she died, aged 72. Her daughter Mary was born in America, married to a Worcester engineer, Leonard Ashton. One of his hobbies was chess, and he visited Worcester College for the Blind on a regular basis to teach and play chess with the boys there. So that all brings it back round to the care of partially sighted people, with the Blind College included at the end. So it's quite interesting that she actually started her life in this building, which is really interesting. Okay.
Thanks, Kate. That's very nice. Now me. This is a story about Percy Thomas, nicknamed Pumpy. Has anyone heard of him? No? No? Nobody's heard of him. Okay. Pumpy Thomas, the faithful city's windmill king of the whole world.
Wow.
So you should have heard of him. And apparently, his ancestors, or I say probably great-grandfather possibly, started a company called Climax, which produced windmills for pumping up water, etc., in various countries that needed that type of thing. Africa was one of the important clients, etc., even America. And Percy Thomas Pumpy, went to the firm in 1903, when he was a young apprentice, really, for his firm. And but he, as he grew older, he became quite a practical joker. And so this is the story about Pumpy. Local historian John Hinton had known Pumpy well during their years as fellow bell ringers at Clane's Parish Church. Now, the reason I picked this story really is because Kate lives in Clane's, and Clane's is the local church. Okay. It was thanks to Pumpy's generosity that the small peal of bells at Clane's gradually grew to a set of 12, enough to rival any cathedral. In fact, one of the bells at Worcester Cathedral was donated by Pumpy in memory of his father. During breaks in the ringing, Pumpy would come round with refreshments in form of a box of snuff. There was certain ritual in this, and a pinch had to be taken between the forefinger and thumb of the left hand, not the right, and anyone who used the right hand, he stood to be sternly rebuked. Okay. John also recalls with great amusement Pumpy's legendary bumper banknote. He had a £1,000 banknote specially printed for him by the Bank of England, and he always carried it around in his waistcoat pocket. He had a great sense of humour, and when calling for a round of drinks in a pub, he would casually tender this note as if it were an everyday currency. Invariably, he did manage to find the right enough loose change and return the note to his waistcoat pocket. The late Vernon Wiggins told John Hinton, too, of a further example of Pumpy's practical joking. He was also always half promising people he would remember them in his will. When he died, there was indeed a will, and remembering every one of them, but he never signed it. Okay, right now, we'll have one of your stories, Alan, or the only one you'd actually brought with you this time,
just
wasn't it?
Just brought the one this week.
Yeah, yeah.
In previous chats, I have mentioned my training as a path lab technician and also my RAF service. I thought it might be amusing, even instructive, to talk more in depth about my time in the mob. I'm talking a few years back, of course, but not as far as biplanes. World War II had finished only 6 years before, and the powers that be decided it would be wise to keep our armed services at a high level, just in case. Those listeners of a certain age will remember National Service, where young people just starting on their first proper job were drafted into the services for 18 months, wasting time doing something in which they had little interest and no future. Now, in my own case, I opted for 3 years as a regular. I didn't regret my decision at all, although those first 8 weeks were tough. I was invited to attend RAF Cardington in Bedfordshire for induction and kitting out. This consisted of standing at a counter and being buried under a blizzard of clothing, all in the same colour, in the hope that some of it fitted. The other memory is being taken to an enormous hangar to see where the British airship Yar-101 was fitted out. I had never been inside such a huge building before. Truly spectacular. The next step was RAF Bridgnorth, where for the next 8 weeks, basic training. This consisted of how to walk in a military fashion, how to handle and fire a rifle and a Sten gun, and how to move in a very large group in a coordinated style on the square. We also found out that when moving from one activity to the next one, the approved method was at the devil. Following weeks passed by in a blur of activity, punctuated by a drill corporal whose sole purpose in life appeared to be making life as uncomfortable as possible for us. There were moments, of course, when we had the laugh out loud occasions, so I'll try and remember the more repeatable ones. The rifles we trained on were SMLE, short magazine Lee-Enfields, and these were to be kept in immaculate condition. So one evening our drill corporal announced that tomorrow was camp commander's inspection, so all rifles were to be in A1 tip-top condition or else. We were set to using the approved method, and after about half an hour I glanced over my shoulder and saw to my absolute horror that my mate Stuart had completely dismantled his weapon. Big bolts, little bolts, all sorts of little screws and springs, a barrel, a wooden stock, everything. Before I could even ask him what the heck he'd done, our drill corporal appeared at the foot of the bed and inquired in an unfriendly manner why he had done that. My mate said quite calmly that he'd been told to clean his rifle thoroughly, and that's what he was doing. The drill corporal exited while stating that if that weapon was not reassembled correctly within the next 30 minutes, my mate would be on a charge in the morning for damaging government property. The silence in that hut was deafening. Stuart, who had a little smile on his face, just put his specs back on. Within about 15 minutes, had completed the impossible. Rifle reassembled and in excellent order. When the corporal reappeared, he examined the rifle with an expert eye and realised that he was on the wrong end of a leg pull, but didn't know how or why, so he just left the hut. And Stuart revealed that before he joined the RAF, he was an apprentice armourer at Vickers Armstrong at Barrow, and they made them by the hundreds. Brilliant, that was. Another occasion when I was in danger of being charged happened when we were parading outside the huts before moving off somewhere else, and the drill corporal barks out, "Lofty, here, now, at the double." I started off down the concrete path towards him at a brisk pace, and mentally measuring my distance to come to a halt before him, slammed my right boot on the ground to stand to attention. I can recall even now my horrified amazement when I found myself still moving forward after the metal studs on my boots failed to provide sufficient grip. There was I, 6'3", standing strictly to attention, proceeding at a stately speed on a collision course towards a superior non-commissioned officer, who, in turn, was viewing this performance with similar amazement. At last I stopped, boot cap to boot cap and nose to nose. Well, not quite, because he was a bit smaller than me, but you get the picture. Drill corporal just managed to conceal a little smile and said quietly, "You were so close to being charged with assaulting an NCO. Now fall in and behave." I must admit that it's almost impossible to get one over on a drill corporal. They've been there and done it. But it did happen on one occasion when we marched off the parade ground after a very difficult drill session. There were three separate groups, Flight 1, Flight 2 and Flight 3, each with about 100 men. I was right-hand marker on Flight 3, which was the last flight to enter the square. after the drill was concluded, the first to exit. As in all military movements on a parade ground, you only do as instructed when your own group is commanded. So we came out, and as we heard commanders going out to other flights, carried on marching straight ahead. Then came a slightly louder order for Flight 1, which was quite quickly repeated at screaming pitch, accompanied by the sound of running boots, as our drill corporal stationed himself by my right ear, wanted to know what the hell did I think I was playing at, ignoring his commands for Flight 1 to turn left. I said that I did hear the command to left turn, but as we were Flight 3, I ignored it. He was so embarrassed he couldn't even speak. On reflection, square bashing was a tough and at times humiliating experience for young men not long after leaving school. It got easier when the penny dropped after a few weeks. You're being trained to act as a member of a team, not as a bunch of individuals. As far as I was concerned, I learned a lot about myself and even more about my fellow man.
You know, I was called up to the Air Force in 1943, and I think the discipline was a lot less then than it was in your day. There was a couple of stories I remember that were short, otherwise the other ones were quite long. But in training, they had to climb this ladder and then get hold of a stick attached to a rope and then let slide down at what he thought was a tremendous speed. And there was a big pole at the other end where the rope was attached. And the guys that went out said, "Oh, I don't think we do that." And the sergeant that went with them said, no, you must do it. You've got to do it. I said, "Well, we're not." So the sergeant said, "Well, why won't you do it?" And they said, "Hey, look, it looks far too dangerous. It's ridiculous. We're not doing it." So I said, "Okay, will you do it if I do it first?" And they said, "Okay, if you do it first, we'll do it." So this chap climbed up this ladder, got hold of this stick on this rope, and slid down the rope and smashed straight into the pole. Oh. He was rather short. And so as he let go, sort of rather bruised, the others were already walking back to the camp. And so, you know, they said, "I told you it was too dangerous," basically. And the other story quickly was that when the Americans were here, my father's squadron, I suppose you call it, had to be on display. They were, can't remember the word. They were on, you know, on a parade with the Americans. Mm. That's the word. And because it was something to do with the Americans, they were, after the parade and everything was done, they marched off first. But this parade happened a lot later than it was supposed to, and hence the RAF boys had all gone in the pub. And the parade went on for quite some time. When the Americans marched off and the RAF were behind them, the RAF went so fast they started overtaking the Americans. And if it had been a long march, they would have got completely past them. Anyway, that's another story. Okay, Mike, what have you got?
We're speaking on, I think it's the 3rd of May today, so I'm just going to read a quick thing about May Day, one of the big sort of, well, in days of old, it was one of the most looked forward to day in England.
Oh, yeah.
So some of those traditions have sort of lived on.
Usually good weather as well.
Yes. Yes. Yes, it's never a
pole and so on.
Yeah, exactly. So this is it's actually from Kent Life, and it talks about May Day, and it says it's an ancient festival marking the first day of summer. Well, almost. It's a time when communities come together to celebrate the blessings of spring and the upcoming summer season. Traditional English May Day festivities usually include Morris dancing, crowning a May Queen and dancing around a maypole. Delicious food, family fun, parades and music are also on the cards. So celebrations are believed to have originated from the Celtic festival Beltane. Celts believed that the 1st of May was the most important day of the year. It signified the split of light and dark as the change in season welcomed the sun after a long winter. Well, yeah, we're still waiting for that, aren't we? So on with this day, the Celts held the Beltane festival, in which fire was used to symbolically celebrate the return of life and fertility. Here's a few do-you-knows. To ward off witches and bestow good luck, people would decorate their house on the eve of May Day with sunshine yellow flowers such as buttercups and marigolds. Legend also has it that washing your face with dew on the 1st of May beautifies the skin and brings good luck. It's been said that Henry VIII's first wife, her again, Catherine of Aragon, and her ladies bathed in morning dew on the morning of May Day. In France, bundles of flowers are tied round the tail of a cow. That's a job to volunteer for, isn't it? Which is then guided through a parade. For those fortunate enough to get close and touch the cow, it was believed to be blessed with good luck. Maypole dancing. That can be traced back to medieval times and was believed to have started as a fertility ritual to bless the crops as well as encouraging human life. Going back to cows, it was thought that milking your neighbour's cow on the morning of May Day would grant you good luck and make your own herd of cows produce lots of milk throughout the year. We were quite daft in those days, weren't we, really? Yeah, but
no television.
No television, so you made your own entertainment, I think. And that's probably actually the key why they were so looked forward to. Yeah. It was something different.
Absolutely.
Morris men, I just... I don't know what that's all about, really.
A friend of mine's a Morris guy.
Really?
I like it.
Do you?
It,
yeah. The flapping hanky and
it's a reason for getting away from your wife for a night.
I see.
Because they always end up in the pub.
Oh,
I've got a relative who was a keen Morris man. Yeah. I don't talk about it very much.
No.
Oh, I see.
I always think it's ironic that it's a fertility thing and yet they look the most how should we be kind?
Don't be.
No. I always think good luck with that. Looking quite a catch in your... always look as though they've got the things on the ribbons on their on their trousers ankle level. The bells, the hanky and the...
They go around hitting each other
with sticks. That's what I think the modern lady is looking for, definitely. So good luck with that. But it's a tradition we should try and remember. But like you say, the television, the internet are a bit more of an attraction these days.
Hasn't it?
Yeah.
Is that the end of
That's it. That's it. That's it for May Day for another year.
Oh, yeah. Well, we should have it more often. Kate, what have you got?
I've got... I've got something about people called the Peculiar People. I don't know whether anyone has heard of them. But
it's the Morris men again.
No. Very different.
You've got definitely something against them.
I'll tell you. This is a bit more sort of serious, I suppose.
All right.
The Peculiar People were a Christian group founded by James Banyard in Rochford, Essex in 1838. Banyard, the impoverished son of a ploughman, was born in the town in January 1800. He became a dissolute youth with a reputation for drunkenness. He was later jailed for petty acts of smuggling and poaching. He married his first wife, Susan Garnish, in 1823. His drunkenness worsened and culminated in him losing his money and, it is said, most of his clothes at a fair. Susan demanded that he change his ways or she would leave him. So he started to attend a Wesleyan chapel in Rochford. It is believed he soon saw the light, became a teetotaler and even preached on occasions. In 1837, Banyard became friendly with William Bridges, who was a visiting Methodist preacher from London. he was so taken by his new friend's views that he became a born-again Christian, preaching forgiveness in all its forms. But his zeal did not find universal favour with all the chapel members, and he was refused permission to hold his own evening prayer meetings. Banyard's strength of character and self-belief resulted in a split among the chapel members. He attracted a group of followers known as the Banyardites. They strongly believed in spiritual healing and the power of prayer and refused the use of the medical profession. Banyard and his followers called themselves the Peculiar People, from a phrase in the Bible that appears in both Peter and in Deuteronomy. He said the group's name reflected a translation of God's cherished personal treasures. Their form of worship was based on their interpretation of the King James Bible. In 1843, Banyard married for the second time to Judith Knapping, and they had seven children. His wife was from a wealthy family, and this enabled him to buy a plot of land on which to build the Peculiar People's first chapel, and he became the group's first elected leader. Sometime later, Banyard's son fell seriously ill, and he summoned help from a doctor, which caused dissent among his flock, and many left. He continued to preach until he died in 1863. In 1910, there was a diphtheria outbreak in Essex, which split the followers again into old peculiars and new peculiars, depending on their views on the use of medical care. This split wasn't healed until the 1930s. By 1956, members had changed the group's name to something less divisive, namely the Union of Evangelical Churches. A chapel was built, but in the 1980s it was demolished to make way for a housing estate. There were other changes too, which included the creation of the Rochford Community Church in 1987. The Union of Evangelical Churches continues in East London and Essex. The original name of the Peculiar People is almost forgotten.
Thank you, Kate.
Different.
When I was living in Manningtree before I came over to the Midlands, I was part of the Chamber of Commerce, I suppose, very small. Of course, Manningtree is an extremely small town, and we used to have a festival every year, and I've always wanted to have a radio station, just for, you know, you could do temporary radio stations. I convinced the chamber that it would be a good idea to have a radio station to go along with the festival, so we set up Festival Radio. And one of the things that we went to record was a party at the Yachting Club, where they had a folk group, and I'm going to play you one of the songs. Well, I might play a couple as we go through this this magazine, but this one is a folk song. I won't tell you what it's called, because I'll let the guy announce it. Now, normally, you would think musicians wouldn't get totally hammered before they start.
Well,
but clearly this chap had had a few, and you'll understand why when it starts to play. And here it is.
We are still not fully assembled here, because Wigan Cath are busily getting themselves some food and to fortify them for the rest of the evening.
And they did.
How many of you were here last year when we came? Oh, good. We're glad to see that none of you were fool enough to come back again. Basically, we're a bunch of people who play around the folk clubs and some of the other, well, basically anywhere they'll let us, around the sort of Chelmsford area. Oh, woe is me, and alas, alack, a tear rolls down my cheek as I tell the story of Nelly Clack, the belle of Barking Creek. Her hair was gold. Hang on, I've just realised what I've done. I have started singing the Bell of Barking Creek to the tune of the Ballad of Bethnal Green. It's awfully easily done. Now, I can either start again on either song. So let's...
Woe is me, and alas, alack, a tear rolls down my cheek. As I tell the story of Nelly Clack, the bell of Barking Creek. Her hair was golden as the morning sun, except where the black showed through. And her age has been a steady 21 since 1942. And every day she would wield her barrow and behave like a good girl ought. And she'd only stray from the straight and narrow when the fleet was home in port. For a sailor boy she just could not resist, her mind and her knees grow weak. And every matter over miles is kissed the bell of Barking Creek. One lovely evening when the moon was new, she stood at the garden gates, widely wondering just what to do. Poor Nelly met her fate. A great big stoker by the name of Bert had come into town that day, and he said, Corblimey, what a piece of skirt, and carried her away. And she darned his socks and she fried his bacon, scarcely paused for breath, until one day she was overtaken by a fate that is worse than death. He said, I'm leaving but I'll soon be back, I'll write to you every week. But we know damn well that Nelly Clack is up the Barking Creek. There's no more to tell of poor little Nell, the bell of Barking Creek.
Okay, that was the music. And Alan, you've got something about cities.
Yes, it's one of those things where you glibly say, well, we're in the city of Worcester for a week's holiday. And everybody says, oh yeah, Worcester City, yeah, very nice. But how do you get to be a city? Well, I'm going to tell you. City status in the United Kingdom is granted by the monarch to specific centres of population which might or might not meet the generally accepted definition of cities. While the term city can be associated with various factors, formal UK city status is granted by the monarch on the advice of ministers. Here are some key points about what makes a place a city in the UK. Cathedral or university. Historically, cities were settlements with a cathedral. Many places that are now comparatively small, such as Ely, Wells or Salisbury, have long had a city status due to their cathedrals. However, a cathedral is not a strict requirement for city status. Birmingham, for example, became a city without a cathedral in 1889. Local government structures. These, despite their names, do not directly determine city status. A city will often style its local authority as a city council, but this doesn't create a separate category of local authority. In law, a city council could be a unitary authority, for example, Manchester, a district council, Cambridge, or even a parish council, Truro. Population size. Grants of city status have been awarded to communities based on various criteria, including population size. In recent decades, city status have been granted through competitive bids managed by the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government. The process considers factors beyond just population, such as historical significance and local pride. That's an odd one. Formal grant by the monarch. Although any of the above factors might justify the popular use of the term city, formal UK city status is granted by the monarch. The process involves structured decision making, and city status is conferred through letters patent. In summary, while having a cathedral, a university or a large population can contribute to a place being called a city, The former status is ultimately granted by the monarch based on specific criteria. City status carries no special rights, but it can be a marker of prestige and local identity. So there you go. That's how you become a city.
I never knew that.
Mm. Mike, what you got?
Let's have a look. I've got a a list here, and let's see how many of these sort of... It's about what it's like to be British. And we've got several characteristics. And I know from travelling abroad, everybody thinks we're quite mad. and I've got nothing here that will speak against that. Okay, here's let's see how many of these you're able to tick. Being unable to stand and leave without first saying, right. Not hearing someone for the third time, so just laughing and hoping for the best. Saying, anywhere here is fine, when the taxi is directly outside your front door. Being sure to start touching your bag 15 minutes before your station, so the person in the aisle seat is fully prepared for your exit. Repeatedly pressing the door button on the train before it's illuminated to assure your fellow commuters you have the situation in hand. Having someone sit next to you on the train, meaning you'll have to eat your crisps at home. The sense of relief after your perfectly valid train ticket is accepted by the inspector. Sorry, is anyone sitting here? Translation. Unless this is a person who looks remarkably like a bag, I suggest you move it. Loudly tapping your fingers at the cash point to assure the queue that you've asked for money and the weight is out of your hands. Waiting for permission to leave after paying for something with the exact change. Saying hello to a friend in the supermarket and creeping around like a burglar to avoid seeing them again. Watching with quiet sorrow as you receive a different haircut to the one you asked for. Being unable to pay for something with the exact change without saying, I think that's right. Overtaking someone on foot and having to keep up with the uncomfortably fast pace until safely over the horizon. That's one I am guilty of. Being unable to turn and walk in the opposite direction without first taking out your phone and frowning at it.
Oh dear.
This is one I do, and I always feel silly. Deeming it necessary to do a little jog over zebra crossings while throwing in an apologetic mini wave.
Thank you.
Punishing people who don't say thank you by saying you're welcome as quietly as possible.
Yeah.
The overwhelming sorrow of finding a cup of tea you forgot about. Turning down a cup of tea for no reason, instantly knowing you made a terrible, terrible mistake. Realising you've got about 50 grand's worth of plastic bags under your kitchen sink. You'll have to excuse the mess. Translation, I spent 7 hours tidying in preparation for your visit. indicating that you want the last roast potato by trying to force everyone else to take it. I'm off to bed. Translation, I'm off to stare at my phone in another part of the house. mishearing someone's name on the second time of asking, meaning you must now avoid them forever. Leaving it too late to correct someone, meaning you must live with your new name forever. Let's have a look. Let's have one more. Oh, here's a modern one. Staring at your phone in silent horror until the unknown number stops ringing.
Yeah, I think we've all done that.
And I think a lot of it speaks to our good manners, actually.
We tend to carry it to excess, don't we?
We do carry it to excess. After you. No, after you. No, please, I insist. Yeah. None of us get anywhere.
Although, in supermarkets and places like that, people with their carts come heading straight for you. And they don't, they don't sort of try to go or make an attempt to go around you. They just head straight for you until you get out of their way,
People.
Too many of them.
Too many.
Oh, don't start that story. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Kate, what you got?
I've got something about Martin Cooper, the mobile phone inventor who has a few hang-ups. In 1973, Martin Cooper stood on a New York street and made a call from a portable telephone 27 centimetres long and weighing more than 1 kilogram. It was the first mobile phone as we know it, but all Mr. Cooper could think was, is this going to work? Recalling the event 50 years later, he said, we had no way of knowing this was the historic moment. Does he have any hang-ups about the technology today? Well, the 94-year-old who has received a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona said the loss of privacy and risk of internet addiction that mobile phones has created concerned him. My most negative opinion is we do not have privacy anymore because everyone about us is now recorded someplace and accessible to somebody who has enough intense desire to get it, he said. He added that five-year-olds should be able to use the internet to help them learn, but there needed to be limits on what they could search for. Mr. Cooper has not stopped dreaming about how the mobile phone would develop, but he is not a fan of the sleek squares of metal and glass that sit in our pockets. He thinks smartphones could evolve to be distributed as sensors around the body, measuring people's health at all times. Batteries could even be replaced by human energy, he said, adding, you ingest food, you create energy. Why not have this receiver for your ear embedded into your skin, powered by your body? Goodness. He doesn't understand all the latest apps, though. There are many things that I have not yet learned, he said. I still don't know what TikTok is. My goodness, a 94-year-old man, is he?
What year was that, 93?
He's 73.
Oh, so of course it would be 73. Yeah. Have you got a portable phone, a mobile phone?
Yeah.
Who hasn't?
Oh,
children haven't?
I got my first mobile phone in the late 70s. You know, the brick.
Oh, yeah. Brick. That was mostly battery, wasn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. And, I I had it strapped over my shoulder, you know, as I walked around, and you know, you feel really proud. I've got one.
Yeah.
Now everyone's got one. You hide them.
I saw something the other day that people don't actually use them as phones.
Oh, I know. Mini computers, aren't they?
Yeah, they're mini computers. Apparently, a bit like the phone ringing, hoping it goes away. Teenagers will see it ringing, see who it is, and then text back. They do not want to speak to people.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's mobile phones. They're mobile, but they're not really phones anymore.
No. Well, there's so much on them, isn't
yes.
there?
Yes.
Yeah,
so very much clever.
Right, OK. I've got a story here about Julie Andrews, who's 88 now. But on her 79th birthday, she sang this song. To commemorate her birthday, actress and vocalist Julie Andrews made a special appearance at Manhattan's Radio City musical for the benefit of AARP. I've got no idea who AARP is. Anyone idea? One of the musical numbers she performed was My Favourite Things from the legendary movie Sound of Music. And here are the year lyrics she used, which were slightly different from the original ones. Bow tops and nose drops and needles for knitting, walkers and handrails and new dental fittings, bundles of magazines tied up in string. These are a few of my favourite things. Cataracts and cataracts, hearing aids and glasses, Polydent and Fixodent and false teeth in glasses. And I've lost the rest of it now. Oh, I've got it. Pacemakers, golf carts, porches with swings. These are a few of my favourite things. When pipes leak, when bones creak, when knees go bad, I simply remember my favourite things and then I don't feel so bad. Hot tea and crumpets and corn pads for bunions, nice beans, spicy hot foods, cooked with onions, bathrobes and heating pads, hot meals they bring. These are a few of my favourite things. Back pain, confused brains and no need for sinning. Thick thin bones and fractures and hair that is thinning. And we won't mention our short shrunk frames. We remember our favourite things. I think that'll do. So, he said, when joints ache, when hips break, when eyes grow dim, then I remember the great life I've had, and then I don't feel so bad.
Yeah.
Yes, that's Julie Andrews. She had, obviously had a sense of humour, the lady.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can see that.
Okay, now we go to the quiz, I think. Okay. You probably won't remember, but last time we had the quiz, all the team read out a question, and we leave it for a few seconds so that you at home get the chance to see if you know what the answer is. And then the team have a go at knowing what they know about that particular thing, if they know anything about it whatsoever. Right, okay. I'll start, I think. I've just been looking at the thing. What breed of dog is Snoopy? 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
Beagle.
It's a beagle. And you're right, it is a beagle. It was in a film. Who was in the film? Snoopy and the Bandits? No? What was Snoopy in?
Charlie Brown Christmas and all those. Oh, yeah. Peanuts.
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 Peanuts. Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Cool. Charlie Brown, as you might say.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Alex. Lucky you're there. Alan, what you got?
apart from Jesus Christ, which historical figure is believed to have been depicted in more films than any other person?
Oh. Okay, I think that's enough time.
Napoleon.
We haven't started answering yet.
I thought you said...
Yeah. No, there's enough time for the listeners to... Napoleon, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Do another one, Alan.
Yeah, do another one.
Right. Sorry about that.
No, Napoleon was fine.
Well, it's good you save me from shouting out the word Hitler. Dodge that one.
Yeah, no, Napoleon died on Elba. No, he went to Elba first, didn't he? And
the wallpaper had him in the end.
Yeah, on. Where was he?
By wallpaper.
Where was the last island he went to? Oh, good grief.
St Helena?
No, St Helena was...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, it was either Elba or St Helena.
No, it was...
It was Elba.
No, Elba was the first one. St Helena was the second, I think. Because the Times did an article about him when he went to Elba, and he said Napoleon now hasn't much Elba room.
Oh.
a joke from the Sun or the Times at the time. The Times at the time, that was good. Okay. Anybody else want to chuck in anything about Napoleon quickly? Waterloo. Is that the end? Sorry, Alan, do another one.
Yeah.
Name two of the five most populous cities in the world, based on figures at the end of the 1990s. Two of the five most populous cities.
Populous. Isn't Hong Kong one? No?
I doubt it. I don't know.
Singapore.
Sneak.
The silence is killing us, Alan.
Mm.
Anybody at home have any ideas? I wonder.
If it's not... Well, come on.
What about Vancouver?
Small beer.
Oh.
What country are the most populous... Name a country, then.
Well, China famously is the most...
I assume so, yeah.
Probably Beijing is probably quite big then, I think, but it's quite a big country.
Strange enough, that doesn't even get in... on the list.
Hong Kong? Really? Hong Kong?
There's five, one, two, three, four, there's five cities listed here. One is Seoul.
Seoul.
South Korea.
Yeah.
São Paulo.
Oh, right.
South America. Bombay.
Chicken.
Duck.
Oh, it's duck, isn't it? Yeah.
Jakarta. And the last one, surprisingly, is Moscow.
I was going to, about to say Moscow. Oh,
I wouldn't have chosen that.
One time London was the biggest, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was that imagination?
Yeah. No. Yeah.
And then I believe Hong Kong took over from London at one time. Not Hong Kong, Tokyo. Tokyo. Oh, okay, Mike.
Okay. According to English tradition, a bride shouldn't wear the colour of the fairies. What colour is this? The colour of the fairies. A bride shouldn't wear it.
Shouldn't.
And it's not the one I thought.
No. Is it yellow?
No.
No.
I mean, you often just see white.
Is it purple?
No, but purple will be good. Yeah. I'm thinking a prince-themed wedding here. I think that'd be rather good.
Green?
It's green.
Oh, green, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a fairy colour, is it?
Yeah, apparently.
Oh,
it's nature. I've never seen anybody wearing green at a wedding.
That's probably why.
Yeah. I've not heard that before, but apparently that's...
Kate, what have you got?
I've got... true or false? Hitler's favourite film star was Charlie Chaplin. Now, is that true or is that false?
I would think it was false.
We shouldn't be
I'm sorry, listeners.
Have a go.
I think it's, of course, Charlie Chaplin made a film about dictators, didn't he?
Yeah, made fun of him.
Yeah, making fun of him. Yeah.
The Great Dictator.
Oh, well, that's right. That's it. Thank you.
I think he was on Hitler's hit list.
Yeah, when we go to America.
Oh, behave.
We get him. who was it then?
It's true.
Liked Charlie Chaplin. Good God.
Hitler's favourite film star was Charlie Chaplin.
Wasn't he just looking in the mirror?
I don't know. I didn't know it personally. Thank goodness.
Apparently,
it always comes back around to that bloke, doesn't it? It always does.
Hitler had a tremendous sense of humour, apparently.
Oh, I wondered where you were going. <laughs> <laughs> Oh,
it's me again, isn't it? Okay. This is comparatively easy. By what name is the American airport formerly called Idlewild now known? Okay. JFK.
JFK.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of things got changed to something Kennedy.
In the wake of his
assassination. Yeah.
Do you believe there was two guns?
Oh. I don't.
Of course, that shot that guy did from that block, you know, quite high up.
Yeah.
Getting in with one shot was, you know, a remarkable shot.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Who knows? Yeah. I think they're going to reveal the secret in 100 years' time. So it'd be like something like 2063.
Yeah.
We will find out.
Well, some people might.
Some people might.
JFK, I mean, he was a great president in a lot of respects, wasn't he? I think. You know, I mean, he certainly stopped that Russian build-up in Cuba.
Yes, he took the world to the edge, though, didn't
well,
he?
Yeah, well, yeah, that was Khrushchev did that.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if the Americans had let them get away with that, I mean, God knows what the Russians would have done next, rather like the problem we've got at the moment.
Mm.
Okay, Alan. We go one more round and then we call it a day. Yeah.
Up until the birth of Prince Charles, it was customary for all royal births to be witnessed by whom? The Archbishop of Canterbury, the Home Secretary, or the Poet Laureate?
Who do you think?
Oh, you've got to have a poet in the maternity ward, haven't you? I can't think of anyone more essential than that.
Yeah.
I think it was the Home Secretary.
Home Secretary, isn't that awful?
It's the Home Secretary.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Just double check. Yep, Home Secretary is.
Yeah, that's
well,
right, yeah.
That's not very nice for the woman giving birth to have the Home Secretary sort of standing there going, oh,
I can definitely confirm. He did not stay in the room when she was giving birth. He was in an adjacent room.
Adjacent.
So that he just knew that the baby was born and that she personally had given birth to it. This has come out in recent gossip or fact or whatever you want to regard it as, with the query over Harry and Meghan's children being their own, as it were, and maybe that there's some question about that, which I won't go into now because it's controversial.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But it's come out, that's why I knew about it, because I've been reading this article, quite a good article, not about Harry and Meghan particularly, but about, you know, about the royal births and how they're that's done, and that's still...
Just to ensure that there's no changeling.
That's right, yes. So they're in an adjacent room, but they don't actually see the woman you know, giving birth. But there are nurses and doctors, obviously, in there when that's happening. So, yes.
Okay.
Interesting.
Well, that's it then. The end of the quiz.
No, and we're going around again.
Should we go around again?
If you like.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, let's have another look.
No, it's...
Yeah, you've just been, so it's my turn.
No, I haven't. I answered Alan's question.
Oh, so I beg your pardon. Yes. Yeah, of course you did. Mike,
I rambled on a bit.
God.
Please form an orderly queue.
Quiet.
All right. Who's the only British Prime Minister to have been awarded a Nobel Prize for Literature?
Churchill.
Yes.
Churchill, yeah.
He definitely wasn't... The blonde one that we've had recently.
Boris.
Poor old Boris.
Why poor?
Well, he probably isn't, but...
he's certainly not that, no.
He churns out those books, doesn't he? They're awful books of his.
Yeah, and he's always earning lots of money from articles in paper.
He went to vote yesterday, and as he's the one who made it mandatory that everyone should have ID.
Yes,
he got there and he hadn't got any ID.
Of course, he hadn't. It's only his law. Goodness sake! Yes, I mean,
so.
Yes.
Right, here we go. In 1999, the American Film Institute named the 100 best movies ever. Name two of the top five. Now, this is good for you, for people listening. You can have a good old guess at this.
What was that? Orson Welles.
Yes,
Citizen Kane, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Citizen Kane, that's the one, yeah. That was the top for years.
It was always between that one and the Hitchcock one, Vertigo.
Oh, right.
And over the years, they kind of crisscrossed and sometimes one's in favour and the other one haven't. But those two are usually the top two.
Yeah, Citizen Kane. I did enjoy watching that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vertigo was quite good too.
Vertigo's very good, yeah.
And Vertigo doesn't come into the top five.
Doesn't come into the top five?
No, this is the top five.
Is it a love story, war films or what?
Casablanca, maybe? Or
that's right. Yeah. That's right, Alex. Yes, Casablanca is second.
That voice coming down from the stars.
Yeah, it's a cracking film.
Yeah.
Think David Lean.
Oh, Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh, yeah.
That was fifth.
Goodness me.
When Lawrence was on top of that carriage, you know, when they attacked the train, they got a lip reader to read what he was saying. And he was walking along the top of the waving his arms backwards and went, thank you very much, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much.
Well, I'll tell you, the top five were one, Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Casablanca came second. I love Casablanca, so I'm very pleased about that. Then The Godfather. The Godfather, didn't we? Gone with the Wind. Which is, I think, a lot of ladies' favourites, anyway. Yeah. And then Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah. After that, that's the top five. But
all good ones.
Yeah, all good films. Stood the test of time.
When they were making Casablanca, the script hadn't been finished. And Humphrey Bogart really got irritated about the whole thing. They kept sort of changing the script as it was going along. And who was... They never said in it, you know, play it again, Sam, did they?
That's a myth, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Absolute myth.
You played it for her, you can play it for me.
Yeah, but not play it again, Sam. Yeah. Okay, right. Alan, have you got any more little stories or whatever?
No, I haven't.
I will give you one to read. Here's a little short one. There we are, about... A visit to the royal family.
All right. I've got a little photograph here of a young girl who looks about, she's seven.
Yeah.
In the palace. This photograph is entitled A Castle Visit and Tea with the Queen. Windsor Castle Superintendent Duncan Dewar offers replicas of the coronation orb and sceptre to seven-year-old Olivia Taylor from Sidcup in south-east London after she had tea with Queen Camilla. The blind schoolgirl with a brain tumour sang a Christmas song and gave the Queen a handmade ring when she was invited to Windsor Castle on the 20th of December. A lovely thing to do.
Mike.
Oh, let's have a look. Okay. One of Beatrix Potter's most famous stories tells the tale of Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and which other rabbit? Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and
Peter.
Peter, plain old Peter, isn't it? I think she ran out of inspiration.
Right.
Kate? I've got, this is quite an amusing story, the worst Shakespeare festival. If you want to hold a Shakespeare festival, you should not improve upon the celebrations held at Stratford in 1769 to mark the bicentenary of Shakespeare's birth. They were organised by the actor David Garrick. For a start, the festival was held 5 years late and in the wrong month, but it doesn't stop there. A torrential downpour flooded the fireworks and none of them lit. A wall collapsed in the rotunda and stunned the main VIP, Lord Carlisle. Then the river burst its banks while Mrs. Baddeley sang Soft Thou Gently Flowing Avon in a tent. The triumphal procession was called off twice, and at the fancy dress ball, revellers danced minuets up to their ankles in water. On the way out, 150 of them fell into the ditch. To top all that, only one line of Shakespeare was spoken in the whole 4 days, and that was misquoted. If there be any, speak, for him have I offended. The bard actually wrote, if any speak, for him have I offended. On the last day, the festival fizzled out and everyone went to the races to celebrate Shakespeare's birth there.
No refunds.
Oh, no, they told that in 1769, haven't they?
This is a nice little story. Residents of a town in West Midlands are being terrorised by an aggressive owl that has been dive-bombing them and attacking pensioners, children and pets. The Canadian Great Horned Owl, which can reach 2 feet tall with a 5-foot wingspan, has been attacking locals living in Sedgley, leaving some people saying they are too afraid to leave their homes. The bird, believed to be an escaped pet, is thought to be becoming more vicious as it grows hungrier, or protects its territory looking for a mate. Well, he's going to be lucky, isn't he?
One passing. No.
Rachel Teagale said, it's become a bit of a psycho and people are actually pretty afraid and terrified of it. I don't know. What else we got? They got anything else? Oh, here's one for you, Alan.
Thank you.
Urban foxes. Oh. Other side.
Other side.
Yeah.
Urban foxes prove not so cunning, it says. Urban foxes may be bolder than their country cousins, but city life has not made them cleverer, according to researchers who set puzzles for dozens of the animals. A team from the University of Hull spent 2 years studying wild foxes in 104 locations in England and Scotland by leaving them tasks to do for rewards. Okay. Dr. Blake Morton, the animal behaviourist who led the research, said they found that urban foxes were more prepared to physically touch the puzzles, but did not show any greater inclination than their rural counterparts to try to get inside and claim the rewards. Dr. Morton added, when we left food on the ground without any puzzle, all foxes willingly ate the free food. The study, which included academics from the universities of Lincoln and Glasgow and Atlanta Zoo, is a part of a project aimed at understanding the impact of climate change and urbanisation on the behaviour and cognition of wild carnivores. Well, somebody's got to do it, I suppose, but...
Mike?
Yeah, I've got a little short story, and it's a very blatant attempt to pull on the heartstrings, so tissues at the ready. In the days when an ice cream sundae cost much less, a 10-year-old boy entered a hotel coffee shop and sat at a table. A waitress put a glass of water in front of him. "Excuse me, miss, how much is an ice cream sundae?" 50p, replied the waitress. The little boy pulled his hand out of his pocket and studied the number of coins in it. "How much is a dish of plain ice cream?" he inquired. Some people are now waiting for a table and the waitress a bit impatient with the boy. 35p, she said brusquely. The little boy again counted out his coins. "I'll just have the plain ice cream." The waitress brought the ice cream, put the bill on the table and walked away. The boy finished the ice cream, paid the cashier and departed. When the waitress came back, she began wiping down the table and then swallowed hard at what she saw. There, placed neatly beside the empty dish, was 15p, her tip.
Oh, lovely.
Kate.
The most exciting version of the Bible was printed in 1631 by Robert Barker and Martin Lucas, the King's printers at London. It contained several mistakes, but one was inspired. The word "not" was omitted from the seventh commandment and enjoined by its readers on the highest authority to commit adultery. Fearing the popularity with which this might be received in remote country districts, King Charles I called all 1,000 copies back in and fined the printers £3,000. Bet the people that did read it enjoyed it.
Yeah. So this is, I think, a fairly old article. It said, on a school notice board, will the individual who borrowed a ladder from the caretaker last month kindly return same immediately, otherwise further steps will be taken. You've all heard that one.
Very good.
Yeah. There was, oh, this, I found this one quite, I think I've read this before. In a newspaper, the following advert was found. For sale, gravestone, ideally for someone called Smith. Yeah, I mean, these are looking around a graveyard, it's sometimes funny to read the epitaph. I believe W.C. Fields had put on his, "Frankly, I'd rather be in Philadelphia, a place he disliked." I remember we were we were somewhere then, I can't remember where it was, and there was a woman in the graveyard we were talking to, and she pointed out this grave, and it said, "Here lays Alfred Williams, if you like, who's resting in peace. No, may he rest in peace until his wife joins him again.
Yeah, I always remember Spike Milligan's says, "I told you I was ill."
Oh, yeah. There was also when... what was his name? Who was the name of the goons?
Oh, Harry Secombe, Peter Sellers.
Peter Sellers. Yeah. When Peter Sellers died, I think it was Spike Milligan that sort of said, they were playing a tune or whatever it was, you know, which was, you know, quite good. And someone said to Spike, "Hey, Peter must have really liked that tune." And he said, "No, he hated it." Anyway, we're coming up towards the end. Has anyone else got anything they want to say, read or do before we say goodnight?
Something that we've been discussing owls.
Oh, owls,
a moment ago.
Yeah.
And I was surprised to read this. Where do owls live? Broadly speaking.
There are nesting birds, aren't they?
Yeah. There's barn owls. They must live in barns.
Yes. They specifically look around the countryside for a barn.
For a barn, yeah. Which they're going to convert once they get
permission. Yeah. Turn it into a three-bedroom house.
And then sell it. Yeah.
When I was in France, there was quite a few old castles that were derelict, and you could wander around them.
Chateaus.
This was a castle.
All proper castle.
And where the portcullis was, you could still go up the stone steps to get up to the rooms above. And I went up there, you know, and there was this owl sitting there. And, you know, we were about 4 foot apart. Mm-hmm. And it was sitting on the windowsill of this thing. And it was about, it must have been 3 foot tall.
Yeah.
I thought, my God, you know, and I'll shift back down them steps.
Yeah.
It was massive.
Now, where do they live then?
You may be surprised to hear they live in an owlry.
Oh. Owlry.
What is an owlry?
That's where owls live.
Enough said.
This was a clue in a crossword puzzle I was doing recently.
Yes.
And my sister-in-law was helping. She's rather good at it. And she counted up the number of letters, and she said, "It's got to be owlry." I said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous." Who knew? And it was correct. An owlry.
Okay. Wow. Well, on that,
I have.
We will say, "Oh no, you've got." Oh, Jane's got. Oh, Kate's got something to.
I've got a little poem that you might enjoy, and it's called "The Pleasures of Ordinary Life." It's not funny, but it's very profound, if you like. I've had my share of necessary losses, of dreams I know no longer come true. I'm done now with the whys and the becauses. It's time to make things good, not just make do. It's time to stop complaining and pursue the pleasures of an ordinary life. I used to rail against my compromises. I yearned for the wild music, the swift race. But happiness arrived in new disguises, sunlighting a child's hair, a friend's embrace, slow dancing in a safe and quiet place, the pleasures of an ordinary life. I'll have no trumpets, triumphs, trails of glory. It seems the woman I've turned out to be is not the heroine of some grand story, but I have learned to find the poetry in what my hands touch. No need to always see. The pleasures of an ordinary life. Young fantasies of magic and mystery are over, but they really can't compete with all we've built together. A long history. Connections that help render us complete. Ties that hold and heal us. And the sweet, sweet pleasures of an ordinary life.
Lovely. Thank you very much. That's very good. Yeah, very good. And that's a good place to end. So we'd like to say good night, Alan.
Good night, all.
Mike.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
And good night from me.
Good night from me.
Oh, thank you. The voice from heaven. Good night, everybody.